Hormone Harmony is an all-in-one hormonal balancing solution for women of all ages. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormone changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. Hormone Harmony is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put your life on hold, like hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all these things. And the biggest benefit? Feeling like yourself again. That's what women mention over and over in their reviews. And there are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code VILLAGE at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code VILLAGE for 15% off today.
Like as soon as our adrenaline is activated or our cortisol spikes, it's really hard to be a respectful parent. And I think I've been, because I have to spend so much time resting, I've like been training for this my whole life. You know, like verbal redirection is not all that effective when they're flooded. And his sensory needs became more than just touching me. Then it became much harder. And I guess it's giving myself enough compassion to believe that that is louder deep in him than the way it feels to him when I have to walk away.
Hey there, I'm Alyssa Blass Campbell. I'm a mom with a master's degree in early childhood education and co-creator of the Collaborative Emotion Processing Method. I'm here to walk alongside you through the messy, vulnerable parts of being humans raising other humans with deep thoughts and actionable tips. Let's dive in together. Welcome to our new limited series, Respectful Parenting in Real Life. I get to hang out with some folks and dive into what this work looks like outside of scrolling through Instagram or that picture-perfect snapshot of respectful parenting. What does it look like when you drop the ball, when it's messy, when we're imperfect humans, or when our kids don't respond perfectly as we planned? Buckle up for some real stories from real humans, and I hope that you get to see glimpses of yourself or your kids in these stories to know that you definitely are not alone in this journey. And there's a village of folks walking right alongside you. All right, let's dive in. Hey everyone, today on our episode of Respectful Parenting in Real Life, I get to hang out with Jessica Slice. Hello, Jessica.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy that you're here. We reached out to Jessica, I don't know, it feels like 8 years ago, forever ago, asking her to be on the podcast as it used to be, as the podcast. And then when we did connect, it was like coming into this new era of we're going to do it in series mode. And this series was partially inspired by you, Jessica. So I'm so grateful to get to dive into this with you today. We were chatting about how you, as a disabled human, experience respectful parenting in a different way, and that a lot of what you might see on social media doesn't fall in line with how it happens in your house. And I think that it's such a necessary conversation about how respectful parenting looks different in every home. And there's not one single home that looks like the picture perfect, Instagram perfect, social media scroll. And so I'm jazzed to get to dive into this today. So you have a child who is five. Yeah.
Five. Yep. Khalil.
Awesome. And can you share a bit about just your family unit and what
I guess, really like what respectful parenting means to you as a parent.
Yeah. So I live with my husband, David, and our five-year-old Khalil, and we have a golden retriever named Honey Puppy. And I was familiar with your work and respectful parenting before you reached out, and really appreciate how much you value the internal experience of kids and how much like you see that like behaviors as a reflection of their needs and a reflection of their experience, and not something that they're doing to get your goat or to annoy you or to rebel, that it's not a power struggle. It's an expression of needs. And I really appreciate that. And it's sort of my natural tendency as a parent is to try to hear what Khalil is saying with his actions and his words, even when like at first glance, what he's saying can feel pretty irritating or exhausting or like nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I dig that. Actually, just this past summer, we were on vacation and with family, and I was talking about Sage was like 4 months old at the time. And I was sharing how like ever since Sage was born, one thing that felt really uncomfortable for me was the idea of like passing him around. Like, I mean, I guess outside of even just like COVID, just like it made him feel like an object, right? Like people want to hold the baby. And he's been a very engaged human from the minute he was born anyway. But like, I guess like, yeah, the idea of like, you're just going to hold this human. And I was like, oh, there's so many other ways to interact with him. And he also didn't love, he wasn't like a snuggly baby. He wanted to look around. He loved being talked to and laying and stretching and moving. And so there was like a boundary I set a lot where I would say to grown adults who were trying to pick him up or hold him or wanted a turn of withholding him, like, oh, you know what? He seems to be really enjoying being on the ground. He does like X, Y, and Z. And even them, like ways to interact. And I was talking about this on vacation, and the family member was like, yeah, you have such a deep respect for children. And I was like, yeah, I see them as humans. I just like, I think so often we separate it as like, I don't know, like kids and adults, I call them tiny humans. And I think part of that is I really see them as tinier versions of humans. They don't have a full adult brain. They don't have a fully developed prefrontal cortex, right? There's a lot of differences between kids and adults in that sense. But they're humans, and I do see them as communicating with us all the time. Mm-hmm. And so thank you. Thanks for acknowledging that. It really feels like a core part of me and how I show up in the world with kids and this work. What, when you're looking at Khalil's behavior and, you know, the surface versus the needs, how do you get there? Like, how do you in the moment get past the behavior to be able to see? Do you not have parts that surface and say like, this needs to stop, or he needs to know how to do X, Y, and Z and can't communicate in the world like this? Like those parts of me still surface in the moment. And I have to regulate to respond with intention.
So I think, yeah, I think that really like taps into why we originally started talking, which is, you know, that I'm disabled. And when Khalil was a newborn, for his first 6 months, the way that I live in the world almost like meshed perfectly with the way he needed to live for those 6 months. We were foster parents, and so I didn't know we were about to be parents. We got a call about him about 12 hours before bringing him home. So there's really no preparation. But within hours of meeting him, I felt like I got him. Like I felt like I understood his messages. And I think a lot of that is my disability, because I have to spend so much time resting and being still, that I had really learned to tune in to smaller signals. And that, you know, and then also I just loved him. But those first 6 months, it almost like in therapy at the time, I kept saying to my therapist, is something wrong with me? Shouldn't this be hard? Like, should
my gosh. Yes. My gosh. I literally said the same thing in therapy where I was like, the hardest part of parenting right now feels like having to do any other life stuff. But like the parenting part didn't feel hard at first. It feels way harder now in other ways, but that resonates so much with me. Sorry to interrupt you. It was just like,
I'm happy to hear someone else relate to that because I was in a new mom's group at the time and people were having a really hard time and my heart went out to them. And I just kept thinking like, I love this. Am I forgetting to worry about something? Is there a part of this that I should be hating? Khalil and I spent almost all day touching those first 6 months. And I think unlike Sage, Khalil just wanted to touch. He wanted his head on my chest all day long. And I wanted his head on my chest all day long. And because of my disability, I'm used to staying home and I'm used to not moving. And so I didn't feel anxious to get out of the house. I didn't feel like my world had shrunk to just this baby and just my sofa. I felt like my world is like completely vast inside my house with my baby and on my sofa. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of took it for granted during that time that like I can hear what Khalil needs. And then as he started, you know, as he went through his like Erickson stage of developments and started to need independence and needed to explore, and his sensory needs became more than just touching me, then it became much harder. The needs of my body started to conflict more with the needs of his body. Mm-hmm. And also my ability to interpret has become like foggier because often I feel like a little at risk because of his needs. And like, I know you talk about this a lot. Like as soon as our adrenaline is activated or our cortisol spikes, it's really hard to be a respectful parent because you're just thinking like, danger, danger, I need safety. And so it's like it didn't happen really at 6 months. 6 months, he was still pretty inert, but it happened as he became a toddler and now a kid where I get him, you know, we do really, really connect. I'd say we're like pretty in sync, but there are times when it is very difficult. And I almost wish I could go back to those first 6 months me and be like, just soak this in. Do not worry about how much you're loving this because it will get hard. Like, don't you worry.
Oh, I've said the same thing. Yes. And I'm only 10 and a half months in right now. And I look back and yeah, the newborn phase for me, first of all, I didn't share a lot about it because I felt like it was almost taboo to say, like, yeah. I'm really loving the newborn stage and this part doesn't feel, there were a couple of things that felt hard. He didn't take a bottle and that was stressful for me because I knew I was going back to work at some point. So it wasn't this is stressful now. It was like future planning, Alyssa, that was, he's still fast forward, still has never taken a bottle. We figured it out. So, and by figured it out, I mean, I have the privilege of having him at home with a caregiver that I can nurse throughout the day. And then I did feel the loneliness at one point where it just like got to the point of like, I wanted someone else to do the nothingness with, you know what I mean? Like another parent who was home I didn't want to do anything. Like I wasn't trying to like go to the park. I was just like, I want someone else to be on my couch too, that I can share in the nothingness with of like being, you know? And so I did feel that at one point. Those were just to be totally transparent, those two hard things came out, but I agree. I like, gosh, I wish I could tell her it's okay to just soak this up and you're allowed to feel it will get hard. Yeah. Yeah, totally. So when you are looking, you know, one of the things that we talk about in respectful parenting, and we were just having this conversation in the Village membership with an occupational therapist who did a workshop on signaling safety to a child who is in that fight, flight, freeze, fawn mode, and especially when they're in a fight mode, that like their nervous system, if we think of like posturing animals, right? That like an animal postures and another one postures up and they're in a cortisol like fight mode. And so when a human postures up, they're in fight mode. If we have another human that like postures bigger, we're in that fight mode back and forth. And that like a huge part of this is being able to signal safety and that it's a lot of body cues. And it's a physical risk for someone who is not disabled. And so for you, what I'm curious about is like, how do you signal that safety and truly keep yourself safe?
It is. Does that make sense? Yeah, it does make sense. It's really hard. So when Khalil is feeling dysregulated, he tends to crave really intense pressure, which there are some ways I can do that. You know, we have a nugget and I can like fold him in the nugget. But, and I guess taking a step back, I haven't said what my disability is. So I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a connective tissue disorder. And one of the many ways it manifests is that I'm injured very easily. So connective tissue makes that, you know, your joints are made of connective tissue and many things are made of connective tissue. And so I get sprains and strains and dislocated ribs and injuries. Just, I can, you know, my hip can come out of socket from rolling over in bed. So a kid who needs intense pressure can feel really dangerous to me, even if what he's doing is in like, is appropriate.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't have a great way of signaling safety. You know, I do like, I will put up my arms to block myself from him. You know, I end up in a lot of really defensive poses. Like if he's needing high pressure, if he's feeling really flooded or really overwhelmed, then he moves past needing pressure and needing to like, to act that out. I really hesitate to use, it's not like hitting and kicking is as much as like, he's just wanting to express his, expressing how overwhelmed he is.
Yeah, well, releasing that cortisol. I mean, it's got to go somewhere. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And so, you know, I will verbally redirect him to, we have a big, big, heavy poof that he can press and kick and hit. But I'm sure, as you know, like verbal redirection is not all that effective when they're flooded. Like I in those moments, I really need, and I really wish that I had the power of my body that could redirect him. And so there are times when what his body needs is not able to be influenced by my verbal redirection. And so I just leave the room and I have to lock a door behind me. Mm-hmm. And that feeling, like even saying that to you, my chest aches. Like the feeling of saying to him, like, what you need makes me need to leave the room. Like, that's how I hear it, is like that I worry the message I'm conveying to him is like, your needs mean that you're being rejected by me. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's not what I would say to him, but I worry that's what my actions convey. And I never want him to think that who he is and what his needs would make him not accepted by a person.
I think it's easy to feel that if you scroll social media for 4 seconds, there are so many messages about like being that safe harbor for our kids, no matter what, and being consistent. Yeah. We have a post that we bring up a bunch that says like, if you are dysregulated, it's okay to walk away from your kid. If they're safe, it's okay to walk away from them for you. And part of that, I think it's really rad to model for kids that we have needs too, and that we're going to advocate for our safety, and we can love them through all of that. In the same, I love you when you're frustrated. I love you when you're disappointed. There's nothing you could do that would make me love you less or more. And it's my job to keep my body safe so that I can help them keep your body safe. You know, that oxygen mask component. And it makes total sense to me for you to have those parts. And I just want to give that part of you like a big old hug and be like, yeah. And there are these other gifts that I think are really crucial. I think a huge message in respectful parenting that can come up is almost this idea of like relinquishing our needs for theirs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to call bullshit. I actually think that like the most powerful way to teach them about advocating for their needs and that they're allowed to have needs is to model that we're allowed to have needs.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.
Are you overwhelmed by the things that get in the way of you doing what you want to do? Are you looking for ways to simplify life to better align with your values? Do you want to create space in your schedule so you have room for more of the good stuff? Play, joy, relationships, gratitude, and more? If you answered yes to any of these questions, I invite you to check out Edit Your Life, a podcast to help you edit the unnecessary from your life so you have more room to enjoy the awesome. Through episodes with me, Christine Coe, and a range of super smart, compassionate, and thoughtful guests, you'll come away with big picture insights and practical ways to declutter your home, schedule, and mental space without getting bogged down by perfection. I have always believed that small moments and actions matter tremendously. My goal is to help you find agency and space in your life through doable baby steps that will leave you feeling accomplished instead of overwhelmed. Check out Edit Your Life wherever you enjoy your podcasts.
Even when those needs are, but then there are times we're having to prioritize our need over theirs, like in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't think prioritize that modeling theirs. Is effective, even when it's saying like, at this moment, my need, I have to prioritize mine over yours.
Yeah, I do think so. And I think that we can come back in the repair moments and talk mm-hmm. about that and connect around that. And I think that's where repair is so huge and mm-hmm. crucial in respectful parenting and just healthy attachment.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the fear of abandonment or of, I can't handle your hard stuff, right? Of like sending that message. And there is some stuff that I would say, like, realistically, I have to keep myself safe. Like in the same sense that if a child had like a knife and was coming at me, my response would have to be to protect myself in order to then be able to even show up for them. Right. And it would have to be safety first. And it wouldn't be me sitting down signaling safety with an open posture.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so I think to like kind of put that into perspective of like the way that your body needs safety mm-hmm. is important, you know? And I think that as I know you've shared, Khalil lives with, he's a neurodivergent human. Mm-hmm. And so as he's learning more about how his systems work and building in tools for his sensory regulation, mm-hmm. I think it's powerful for him to learn that they're interacting with different humans will look differently and that you can handle his hard emotional stuff and that there are some physical limitations to that and that you will have to set up boundaries to keep your body safe. And that looks different for every single human, what those physical limitations look like and what that, the OT that we just had on, one of the things she was saying was that for especially for kids who go into fight mode, what we're looking at often is that they need some dopamine, like a dopamine hit in order to be mm-hmm. able to get back into their brain. And we were talking about how like this can feel at odds with a lot of respectful parenting. The dopamine mm-hmm. hit is a reward system, right? So right, we're looking right. sometimes at distraction. We're looking sometimes even at yeah. like food or a screen or whatever, something yeah. that gets them out of the animalistic part so that they can mm-hmm. access that whole part of their brain mm-hmm. and start to produce serotonin or oxytocin or whatever. But that as he's learning about his toolbox for dopamine, for accessing mm-hmm. that dopamine, it's so crucial that you keep your body safe. And I truly think that's okay. If he can learn to separate those two things of like, my mom can handle my emotional hardships. And a lot of the time that might come through repair. That's when mm-hmm. he's not doing emotion processing work when he's
no
dysregulated. His body has a flood of cortisol or adrenaline, right? Like his nervous system is dysregulated.
Yeah.
And before we're doing any emotion processing work, we're regulating the nervous system. And it sounds like that is the gap here, is that you can handle his hard stuff emotionally and his nervous system dysregulation can be overwhelming for your system, right? And like those are separate things for me.
That does make sense, because a lot of the connection, you're right, when we're in repair, which I take very seriously, and so usually after something like this happens, we'll end up doing a lot of cuddling and a lot of talking. He has a wonder stick. It's like a filled with sand and sparkles, and you flip it and the sand kind of like falls down through water.
Like meditative.
He's really soothed by that. And I think like going back to the way my disability like impacted those early months is I have the capacity to stare at his wonder stick with him for as long as he wants to, which was literally 45 minutes the other day. We just sat in bed cuddling, watching the wonder stick, and he'd be like, is the moon or the diamond going to fall first? And like, and I think I've been, because I have to spend so much time resting, I've like been training for this my whole life. Sit here and stare at this. And those moments, like we repair in that way. And then we also talk about what happens. And he will say back to me now, because we've talked about it so much, that he'll say, nothing in the world makes you not love me. Nothing in the world makes you not love me. And he knows that in these other moments. And I guess it's giving myself enough compassion to believe that that is louder deep in him than the way it feels to him when I have to walk away.
Mm-hmm. When you have to prioritize your safety.
Yeah. I mean, I even have trouble framing it that way because I'm framing it from his perspective. But yes, from my perspective, I'm prioritizing my safety because there's no other option. I thought of this call yesterday with respectful parenting. So right now I'm a wheelchair user when I'm out of the house, and I'm up in Canada and it's so snowy that I really can't use my wheelchair. Sidewalks aren't shoveled wide enough. So I'm not doing school pickups. So I've been waiting on the sofa inside the front door when he comes home, and he comes home and he removes all his clothes except for his underwear, and he climbs onto the couch and holds my hand, and then the dog licks his toes and he just kind of like rolls around, like just like feeling everyone touching him. And yesterday he came home and he took off his clothes and I was sitting on the wrong sofa cushion, like unintentionally, and he just collapsed to the floor. And then he realized I was holding the wrong blanket too. And I hadn't really internalized like how much this routine was meaning to him until then. He could barely say it. He was like, wrong blanket. And so my husband, I think like what respectful parenting has shown me is that there's no point in those moments being like, this blanket's fine too.
Totally.
Cause like what he's saying is like, I need the safety of our routine. So my husband got the right blanket, brought it over. I moved to the right couch cushion and we caught, and it didn't escalate. He was crying, but he came over, he crawled on my lap. He said, make me like a bird. And so I wrapped him in the blanket and he let me hug him. And I said, what I saw that just happened is that it felt really sad to you to not be able to do what we've been doing every day. And that I didn't realize how much you love that time. And I said, is it important to you that from now on I sit on the same cushion and I have the right blanket? And he said, oh, yes. And I felt like, okay, in that moment, our bodies could work together. Like I could meet him there and hear him. And then there is that part of myself that's stubborn that wanted to be like, oh my gosh, like, don't tell me where to sit and which blanket to use.
Yeah. Oh, I feel all of that. And for me, part of it that like the part that's like, don't tell me where to sit, where blanks use, also says like, they're going to need to have resilience and adaptability in outside of the, that can get huge for me. And Sage is sound sensitive. And that part has come up a bunch in this of like, when to, what that part sees as accommodate this. And he has this noise canceling headphones that he'll put on if we're making coffee or if there's a blender going, or if the vacuum's going, or honestly, if a truck drives by. Yesterday, the wind was loud and it's just like, he's like kept like looking, and I was like, yeah, the wind is loud. And so part of it for me is a balance between like the exposure and yeah, that resilience component, that word comes up for me a lot here of like, will he have the tools to navigate hardships and different things if there's a loud noise around, right? Like, will that get him through? And we went to a wedding when he was 3 months old and he had noise canceling headphones on and was still so dysregulated. He could not be in the space where music was. It was too loud. It was too overwhelming. And oh my gosh, so many parts come up. I'm like, oh, we have such a quiet household. It's the three of us. He was born in COVID, so we're not doing a whole lot indoors. Like, did I feed into this in some way? Like, oh my gosh, all of the like, am I doing the right thing here to prepare him for life ultimately, right?
I know.
And I think you hit the nail on the head though, that the power struggle of, no, he can be fine with this blanket is that part, like digging in its heels, right? And saying like, nope, he needs to learn to have cognitive flexibility. And what I really, really want for kids is to know, like, it's okay to not, it's okay to say like, I feel overwhelmed or sad, or I have needs for safety and consistency and routine. And right now that's you sitting in a certain place with the blanket, and it's going to look different in 3 years. It's going to look different in 5 years. It's going to look different in 7 and 9. I remember when I went away to college and then I returned and my parents had turned my bedroom into like a room with like, it was just like had a few beds in it. I'm one of five kids. And so then like when people were all home, more people could sleep in this room. And how dysregulating it felt for me.
Yeah.
And I didn't grow up in a house where I was able to say like, I feel sad about this, but it felt really sad and dysregulating. And I didn't have the words for it for a while to figure out like, oh, it's because you were expecting to come home to your bedroom and now it feels like you left and this is no longer your space. Like, you don't have a room to return to. It was like the feelings inside my body. And simply that consistency of my bed being there would have been a game changer. And all that to say that like this, the like safety and the consistency and the routine and expectations shows up in our life always in different ways. And right now it's just this one way for him. And what does it really mean to us if he has that right now? What does it mean to me if Sage wears his headphones when we do the blender? Right. You know what I mean? Like, what is that? What's my fear? And what does it really mean short term, long term?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, for me, it's almost definitely like probably unhealthy messages I internalized as a child of like, you need to be tough and suck it up. And it's not like, I think the same resiliency thing too. Like, he can't go around the world demanding where everyone sits, but also he's not, he just came home from school. He came home from a day where people were sitting all sorts of places. He was working so hard. He was wearing his collared shirt that pulls on his neck. He listened, he was practicing writing, which is hard. And if what he needed was to come home and have me sit in a place and use the right blanket, then like, then if I'm outside of my own, like my own trauma and my own like desire to be exceedingly hard on myself, then I would say like, then he gets that.
Totally.
Then like, good for him for saying what he needs. And like you were saying, coming home from college, like, you also had to see, like, you had to be so resilient in college. It wasn't like you were being completely sheltered and then one thing changed and you couldn't handle it. You were doing all sorts of new things and you just needed one thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the part of home. That's the part of secure attachment. That's the part that's different. Somebody on our team and I were just chatting about this idea of like, a kid as your friend. And I was like, I don't see my kid as my friend. And here's why. Like, I think my relationship with Sage should be different than he has with his friends. I want him to know that, again, there's nothing he could do that would make me love him more or less. And that's not true for friends. They're going to come and go, and it's not unconditional love, that's for sure. And I've also had like long, hard days where I've given everything I've got, and I get home from work or from whatever I've been doing, and I don't have much left to give, right? Mm-hmm. To my partner, to our home life, to whatever. And that's what's happening for kids every day. We hear all the time, like, oh yeah, they're holding it together at school, they're not seeing this behavior at school, et cetera. And then they come home and we're seeing a whole different kid, because mm-hmm. they don't have to hold it together for you. They know that you are there to handle that, right? And like right. that for me right. is just a huge sign that Khalil does know that you can handle his hard stuff. Mm-hmm. That yeah. he probably didn't do that same thing at school, you know?
Mm-hmm. He had early in the school year, he did have a day at school where it got to be too much. And we didn't know why, but we got a call from his teachers that he just could not calm down. And we went to go pick him up. And we were so desperate to get to him that I told my husband not to worry getting my wheelchair out of the car. And we planned on parking right in front of the classroom so that like I would be close to them. But what ended up happening, just where we parked, they were about half a block away, and I can't walk that far. And so I got out of the car and sat on the ground a half a block away, watching Khalil weep with his teacher. And David was going to them. And I just like this feeling, it was like another time where it felt like my body and his body, like, how do we make these work together? And I just wanted to be there. And David got to the car with Khalil eventually. I was not handling it well. I was screaming, bring him here, like a like a mother on a movie or something. Just like hollering down the street to bring him to me. And they got to me, and Khalil was just weeping. And we had hoped that we could connect with him before getting him in the car, but there was no way. And so we just mm-hmm. got him in the car seat while he was weeping. And we were trying to talk to him. And I think it clicked for me that talking was wrong, not what he needed. And that like we just needed to give him room to cry. Mm-hmm. And I said, you can scream and cry as long as you need to. And we're here. And at that moment, I was safe. You know, he was in the car seat, I was in the front seat, David was driving. And then eventually he stopped crying. And then we held hands and then we talked. And it actually ended up, your Sage stories made me think of it. His classroom had gotten really loud that day. A lot of people were talking at the same time, and it was just a bunch of 4 and 5 year olds, and it was too much. And then he also didn't eat his protein at lunch. And so we sent him back with some headphones, mm-hmm. and we also sent back some protein drinks for days. He doesn't eat his protein at lunch. His teacher will give him a little protein drink, and it hasn't happened again. It's been months and months. And so he found a way of like getting what he needs, and he hasn't had another meltdown at school. But there was that moment of like, he needed me, and I was stuck on the ground, and we were a half a block away from each other. And I also wasn't helping things. I was not sending safety cues by screaming down the road, bring him to me.
Oh, it's making me tear up because I know the feeling of like, they need you and you aren't there. Or it feels like they need me and I'm not there. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we're supposed to, in a regulated brain, I don't think we're supposed to be there all the time. I think we're practicing and we are their safe harbor when they can access us and come home to us, et cetera. And I want to be there every time.
I do.
I want to. Yeah. And like if anything happens and my mother-in-law does childcare for us on Fridays. Mm-hmm. And I was about to head into a presentation, and I was upstairs, and I heard like that cry that I was like, oh, that's not an I'm frustrated cry. That's I'm hurt, whatever. And I just like, no questions, sprinted downstairs, and he had just fallen and bumped his head. She could have absolutely soothed and supported him. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be there. I didn't want him to experience something hard and for me to not be there. Oh. And I know, I just know that feeling. And I also know that he starts school in September and mm-hmm. I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to be there every time he experiences something hard. And I see the work we're doing now as practicing destiny. I don't know if you follow Destiny, Manifest Destiny is her Instagram handle. Yeah. She did an interview for this podcast series too. And she used this, like, she talks about practice all the time. Like, we're practicing all day long. And I really do see it that way, that like, we are practicing so that he has tools to call on, or so that at the end of the day, mm-hmm. when he needs to break down, when he gets home and we're going to navigate all, I'm going to get the hard stuff, right? Like, he's going to have that tough moment at school or whatever. And then I'm going to get the hard stuff of the processing work later on. Right. And I'm going to try and welcome it with open arms, but gosh, I wish I could just like, I wish that every time he experienced something hard, he would have the safety of a secure attachment caregiver yes. with him. And it's mm-hmm. just not going to happen. And I hate that.
Yeah. That's a great point. And 'cause I frame it as like, I want him to know that his hard feelings aren't too much for me. I want him to know I'm there. But a lot of it is just this, like, our instinct as parents is we also want to be there. It feels like, it's not only thinking about his perspective, it's thinking about just my own desire to be present.
Totally.
Yeah. You had talked a little about like how I am showing him that we all have needs and that respecting mm-hmm. needs is important. And I was going to mention that my husband is actually autistic, and then I speak about my disability a lot. You know, I write about it and talk about it. And Khalil the other day said, I have a disability. I said, what is that? And he said, I love dogs too much. And I was like, all right. But then he said, we are the disability guys. And he thinks of it as like our superheroes. Like,
I love that. Oh my gosh, I love it.
Yeah. And so he says, our family is the disability guys. And I love the openness. I mean, I do really appreciate that he's witnessing like a diversity of ways of having bodies and minds.
Totally. Yeah. And of being, and also that he's going to learn that how he shows up in the world is going to ebb and flow depending on somebody else's body and mind and brain. And that we all do. It's our job to be that like social awareness part of emotional intelligence, that as we start to build our own self-awareness and self-reg skills, then we get to work on the empathy social awareness components. And part of the social awareness is that how I show up in the world with one person is not going to be the same way that I show up in the world with another person. If their brains work differently, if their bodies work differently, we're going to differentiate and adjust how we show up. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that that prepares him for the world.
Yeah. I hope so.
I do. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. What is going differently than you imagined it with respectful parenting in your household?
I would say as he gets older, and I would not, and this is not disability related, but as he gets older, my own stubbornness comes out more. Because when he was less vocal, it was easier for me to filter his needs through like, well, he's a kid. Like he is, I cannot expect him to be reasonable. But as he gets older and like, he's a little bit more logical, I find myself like wanting to, in my like, not as clear moments, say like, no, I'm not going to change the blanket I'm using, or like, when he expresses desire with food, or when he's not wanting to do his homework, which I also have feelings about the fact that he already has homework, but there's parts of me that just wants to be like, just do it. Like yeah. This whole thing, we wouldn't have to, that I find like, yeah, my own stubbornness comes out more than I thought it would. I thought I'd be able to override that.
Yeah. That's interesting. I don't see it as stubbornness as much as expectations. And I think this is true across the board that we all have biases around age expectations, right? And mm-hmm. whether it's by this age, I expect them to be sleeping through the night, or by this age, I expect them to be using their words to communicate with me. By this age, I expect them to not be crying when they're having a hard emotion. By this age, mm-hmm. we all, whether we're conscious of them or not, we have these biases around expectations tied to age. And so often it's mm-hmm. from our social programming, what we were raised with and the expectations for us. And I think this is, when I look at early childhood, what I often see are very low expectations for infant and toddler, yep. and then very high expectations for 3, 4, and 5 year olds, mm-hmm. where we don't expect an infant or a 1 year old, or maybe even a 2 year old, to have skills that I think they're often capable of if we're laying the foundation. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, as 3 year olds, we're like, we expect you to have a toolbox because you're asking us why constellations exist. And it seems like you're taking in all yes. this incredible cognitive information. Mm-hmm. And so why don't you have the social emotional toolbox? And I think it's super common. I think I see it as like biases and expectations that I think you're in the norm. I think all of us have them. And my hub is an infant toddler. And so I just observed over and over and over again the low expectations of infants and toddlers. And I had said one point in our village membership when Sage was teeny tiny, something about he's such a good communicator. Mm-hmm. And one of the parents in there was like, I never like thought of my infant as like a communicator. Like I didn't see it that way. And that it like shifted that framework. And for me, again, I like truly see I see them as tiny humans, and I see these mm-hmm. beings as communicating with us and building these toolboxes. And I think we do kids a disservice in this, because I think that it's impossible to live up to our expectations of them as a 3, 4, and 5 year old if we don't support them with how to have those skills mm-hmm. and the foundations for those skills. And the realistic expectation that no one has access to those skills all the time. Right. And again, back to the like, yeah, I guess it's going to ebb and flow. Like there are some days where I know that this child can get themselves dressed or zip their jacket or whatever. And there are some days that I'm going to do it for them because they're under-resourced that day. You know, like maybe right. there's a lot going right. on, or we had a hard morning and they're feeling drained. I can help you with these parts. I can zip your jacket for you when I know that you know how to work a zipper.
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, whew, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tidy humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.
Well, hey there, busy mama. Are you looking for ways to make your life easier, your home less chaotic, and at the same time, add more joy to your life? My name is Deanna Yates, and I'm the host of Wanna Be Clutter Free, a podcast all about letting go of the stuff we don't need in our lives so that we can focus on what truly matters. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you to throw it all away or make you feel guilty about keeping something you love, no matter how many other people don't quite understand it. but I will give you practical and, more importantly, actionable advice so that you can make progress right away. And you won't just hear it from me. There are amazing guests too. It's like having your bestie in your pocket, telling you it's okay to let go of the things that are not serving you and your family in a totally non-judgmental way. So join me over on the podcast where we can work on progress over perfection for those of us that want to be clutter-free.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a great point. And I think that mentioning the cognitive development part is really useful because I don't know that I would have identified that that's behind it, but like Khalil recently started doing like some multiplication, which is, and like, he really loves math. He really loves for me to say math problems out loud and for him to do it. And so I think like, if you can do that, then you should also be able to pull your own duvet up to your chin in the middle of the night. Like, and it just seems like, and I hadn't articulated that that's what's going through my mind, but it is like, yeah, if you understand,
you're capable,
you can move a blanket, and that's not how we develop. We don't develop all at once. And we also have different needs, different days. And I have different needs, different days. Mm-hmm. There are times I'm much more patient with my husband. And I mean, we all change our capacities all the time.
Yeah. And the toolbox for multiplication is different than the toolbox for regulation or emotional expression. And it's not lumped together of like, all of these things are cognitive, right? That like, it's, I can like hear my mom in my head right now of, I have one brother who he's wicked smart. Mm-hmm. He can absorb content so fast and retain it. Mm-hmm. And he was her biggest struggle in parenthood. And she would say, "You're so smart. Like, what are you doing?" And I can like hear it. I can hear it as like him in high school going through this. And it's because he had, cognitively, he is so advanced and can absorb content so fast. And social emotional toolbox is different than a cognitive toolbox. Right. And I think we just think of these as like, you're so smart, do it, right? Like I can just say, oh my gosh, I can like hear the phrase coming out of her mouth, and that you're capable of this. And not all the time, even if I am capable of it sometimes, not all the time. And B, it's a different toolbox. It's a whole different, it's like learning another language. And emotional development is one of those things that you don't just get there, right? Like you don't, it's not like you will just, I mean, we can see this in adults all around us. You don't just all of a sudden reach an age where you have a toolbox for regulation and processing emotions. There are things that have to be learned, that have to be taught. Mm-hmm. And if they're not, we will create maladaptive coping mechanisms and we'll express in ways that are not pro-social. And I think that part of this is we expected kids to get to a certain age where they just have these tools, and it's an ongoing teaching, learning, practicing process.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it requires a lot of emotional energy from us.
Totally.
Or from me, to not react from expectation and to not react from exhaustion, or even like this kind of ego, like where I'm just like irritated or cranky, or, you know, or the part of me
inconvenienced.
Yeah. And I will say, like, something I've been really thankful for and proud of as a parent is that I don't really have much of a temper. I would not say when I'm feeling irritated, that's where I go. It's more that I feel, it feels more like irritation, and I feel very thankful for that.
Yeah. You don't go into fight mode.
I don't. And I think that's just, I mean, I think it's probably my own work I do on regulation, and I have some pretty good like coping strategy habits, but I also think it's temperament. Like I don't, I think But I know that's something I worried about as a parent. It's like seeing parents scream at their kids and lose it really frightens me. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you know until you're in it, are you going to be someone who goes to that mode? And
yeah,
I've just felt really, and my husband isn't either. And I felt really thankful that our house doesn't go there.
Yeah, same. I don't usually go into fight mode either. My reaction is flee or freeze. And I don't know that it's better. It's just different. But I think it looks better. It looks better on the surface, right? Like it presents better. In the same way that a kid who freezes or goes quiet, there doesn't mean they're not feeling. It doesn't mean that they're regulated. It just is what we consider more pro-social in that they're not hitting, kicking, screaming. It feels different on the surface, but yeah, I'm not yelling at him, but it doesn't mean I'm always available emotionally and supporting him. Mm-hmm. When I freeze, it's like a, whoa, like, yeah, it's not the same as when I'm calm and connected and he's dysregulated. It's different. But same, I usually my reaction is not typically fight mode with kids. It is with adults. Okay. I'm like, you want to go to battle? Actually, the other day, Zach said something and my husband said something and he hit a wound and I fired back and I was like, oh, you want to go to battle on this? And he said, Alyssa, never once in our decade of being together have I wanted to go to battle with you. And I was like, okay. And it was like the reality check they needed. I'm like, oh, yep, I'm going into fight mode right now because I feel attacked about this thing. And it was something so little. It was about Sage's he was like, oh, Sage's nails have gotten long. I feel like there's like a dagger that keeps getting me. And I'm the one who clips Sage's nails. And so I was like, well, if you ever clipped his nails, that wouldn't be happening. Feel free to do it. Right. Like that, like part of me that just goes into that like fight mode. And I was like, do you want to go to battle? And I literally said, and he was like, not once have I wanted that, but I will do. That is more my reaction with adults, but with kids, it's not. I go into more freeze mode. It's interesting.
Their nails grow. I know this isn't the point, but and sometimes I feel like how, as parents, are we not only talking about our kids' nails? Because I feel like I can never be on top of it. And it's such a pain to cut them. And I'm just like, no one else is talking about this. Does everyone else just think this is not a big deal?
No. Yeah. We're screaming about it at our house, apparently.
That's very comforting.
Oh, man. And Jessica, for my last question for you, what do you feel like is missing in the respectful parenting community, like discussion? And as you scroll, what do you think is missing?
I could, you know, it could be that I haven't seen it, but in the imagery and kind of in the discussion, I haven't seen a lot of visible disabilities. Mm-hmm. And I know that really matters to me. And it also really matters like to Khalil. Like he notices when we are reading books or we're watching shows, he'll say, where's that mama's wheelchair? And like to him, it's like assumed that a mother would be using adaptive equipment.
Yep.
And so I know, I mean, you're probably talking more content, but as a disabled parent, I can feel like we're sort of invisible. Like there's a lot of shame about having physical limitations. And I think it's a lot of sexism that like, and I think you push against this in many ways, saying like mothers don't need to be superheroes. But like our societal expectations is that mothers need to be superheroes. And therefore like a mother with a physical disability or intellectual or cognitive disability is like a shameful kind of mother. And I think a way to fight that is to show us in like our disabled beauty.
Totally. Well, and I think on the content side of that, I'd imagine there's a lot missing. And I think we can definitely do a better job of this around respectful parenting when you have a disability, when you have to prioritize your safety, when you do have to walk away, right? The fact that like those are all things that are coming up for you. And I wonder, maybe I'm just not seeing them, if there are spaces where folks are talking about that more, not just around that if you're, you know, we talk about if you're a dysregulated adult, it's helpful to take space and regulate before you can co-regulate. But if you have to keep your body safe, if you can't pick your kid up and give them that bear hug, if you can't move them to a safe space to express, what does this work look like? I feel like we could do a better job of that representation-wise in content as well. And I don't see it in the respectful parenting community.
No, I mean, it's not in really any parenting community. The place I see it is in disabled parenting, like Facebook groups.
Yeah, there's,
you know, I'm in a, you know, parents with disabilities Facebook group with a couple thousand, and all of these conversations, I mean, daily, of like both, you know, advice about what kind of crib can you get kids in and out of while you're in a wheelchair, to like, you know, I saw a post today, a parent was saying like, I just can't keep our house looking peaceful with my disability and my kids' needs. And like, which I think is a common, you know, I think that's the, and we've kind of touched on this, but I haven't said it explicitly. I think that is the thing about disability, is that we are all on the spectrum of disability. Like anyone who's not disabled is only not disabled for now. We are all disabled at some point in our lives. And so there's this like threading a needle of like, disability is not a unique identity. And then also it is, like, there's this also kind of beautiful culture around disability. And so like, it is both a social construct and something really, and because of that, there's also something really beautiful there. And so I think like the aches as a disabled parent are unique to us, and then also not unique to us. Like when I was stuck on the ground, not able to go to Khalil, like, you cried because that resonated for you, because there's been times where you have like been stuck away from Sage. So I just think like so many identities, it's like both separate and then also not separate.
Yeah, this is maybe kind of makes me cry again. Thinking about it, maybe a gross part of my postpartum experience, but I had a vaginal birth. I did not tear. My rectum did not tear. Beautiful. Great. Thank you. Perineum's intact. And then like weeks postpartum, got an anal fissure that ended up being a month's long colorectal appointment ordeal that I was in physical pain. Anytime I went to the bathroom, or whenever I went to the bathroom for that day, I would then be in so much pain. I couldn't sit. Walking hurt. Like really what I could do is lay, and I had lost like most control in terms of like when I had to go, I had to go. And so that for me, there were multiple times postpartum where, again, it was like the parenting part wasn't the hard part for me. It was that,
right.
It was the, like my body needing to be prioritized over caring for him. And there were times that he would be like nursing to sleep, and I'd be like, oh, I have to set him down in his crib.
Yeah.
And he's now crying because he was nursing to sleep. We weren't done nursing. He wasn't asleep yet. And I'm interrupting this, setting him down in his crib and running to the bathroom. And then I'm going to be in pain. And then afterwards I have to do a sitz bath for 20 minutes and can't do that until I get him back to all those like, and then I can't sit for the rest of the day today. I can't sit to nurse him. I can't sit. I couldn't sit to ride in the car. So I couldn't, I felt like I couldn't leave the house for a while. Yeah. And that was where my head went when you shared the sitting on the ground and not being able to get to him, of like, mine was sitting on a toilet, but yes.
Yeah.
Sucked. It sucked.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I appreciate that. Like, and I don't at all want to say like, I know at all what it's like to live as a disabled human. Like I think you're right. It's like threading that line of, there are some things where I'm like, oh, I resonate with this part or connect with this. And I don't know what it's like to be you, and treading that water, I guess.
But isn't that like the magic of like detailed stories and not just like focusing on like macro identity? Cause it's in stories that like we're able to really connect. It's like sharing the actual moments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing your real raw moments. And sorry that you had to hear about my beehole.
I'm so thankful that you shared. That sounds horrible.
It was really, really, really rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. in a much better place now, thank goodness. Yeah. Thank you for hanging out with me and for just sharing this, the reality of respectful parenting in your home. And if there's anything you have to share, please.
Okay. I have a couple picture books coming out about disability.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So one is called This Is How We Play, and they're coming out with Penguin. So you'll be able to find them like on Penguin Random House website or anywhere you buy books. And This Is How We Play. Each page celebrates a family with a family member with a disability and the like unique adaptive ways they play. And This Is How We Talk is the second book. And they're both co-written with Caroline Cupp, and it celebrates how people communicate with disabilities. So talking about AAC devices and sign language and board communication and people who use little buttons on their belly button to answer yes, no, and just all sorts of like beautifully adaptive communication. So it shows disabled parents and disabled kids and disabled teachers. And I'm really, really excited. And my co-author and the illustrator are disabled people too.
Awesome. Incredible. When do they come out?
The first is 2023 and the next is later in 2023.
Okay, cool.
And my Instagram is my name and I'll post updates.
Great. And your name is Jessica Slice. For folks, as a reminder, head on over, follow Jessica. And when the books are live, we'll also share about them on our Instagram.
Oh, too, so thank folks you. Can,
yeah, of course. What an incredible tool you're creating. Thank you for doing so.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Voices of Your Village. Check out the transcript at voicesofyourvillage.com. Did you know that we have a special community over on Instagram hanging out every day with more free content? Come join us at seed.and.sow, S-E-W. Take a screenshot of you tuning in, share it on the gram, and tag seed.and.sow to let me know your key takeaway. If you're digging this podcast, make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. We love collaborating with you to raise emotionally intelligent humans.
Oh, hey, everybody.
It's us, Blair and Molly, your old pals from Toddler Purgatory. Two moms who are also actors, who are also creative beings, who sometimes feel stuck.
And this is our new podcast, Unsticking It with Blair and Molly. What happens when your creative spark just seems to disappear?
Gone.
Poof.
Bye.
See ya. What happens when life gets in the way of your creativity instead of nourishing it? That's what happened to Molly and me. We felt like the thing that drove us creatively stopped working and impending doom had in fact impended.
Totally. So we decided to do something about it. And that was steal ideas about getting unstuck from the most creative people we can find. We talked to guests about how to break through the mucky, gluey, sticky wall that can get between you and your creativity. We hear about their journeys, their successes, their challenges, and even their bougie coffee shop orders.
And we're not just talking Bob Ross type paint on paper artists here, though we talk to them too. We're talking to actors, creative directors, dancers, and people who are working hard to be their best creative selves in a world that can sometimes feel real uncreative.
We all have something to teach each other, so let's steal their ideas together.
Join us, won't you, as we deep dive into how to unstick ourselves from the life gunk that can get in the way of our creative freedom. Pandemics, school calendars,
world events, lack of sleep. Oh, get out of their life gunk.
And let's get back to your best creative self. Subscribe to Unsticking It with Blair and Molly.
You're not going to want to miss an episode.
Unsticking It with Blair and Molly, because sometimes life sucks.
Unsticking It.